Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. President Trump may be facing his most serious crisis to date, the result of a stunning press conference yesterday in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin of Russia. Trump shocked the nation and much of the world when he failed to rebuke the Russian president and turned his back on his own intelligence officials about Russian election hacking.
I hold both countries responsible. I think that the United States has been foolish. I think we've all been foolish. We should have had this dialogue a long time ago. A long time, frankly, before I got to office. And I think we're all to blame.
The reaction in the States has been bipartisan alarm and outrage, with politicians and officials of all political stripes condemning the president's performance in Helsinki. This hour on Point, Trump and the fallout from Helsinki. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of what President Trump did and said in Helsinki yesterday? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me first from Arlington, Virginia, is Nancy Cook. She's White House reporter for Politico. And Nancy, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you.
Oh, hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
So give us a quick update today about reaction in Washington. What are you hearing? What's the range of reactions from what happened yesterday?
Well, I think that there is a lot of outrage about what happened. A lot of Republicans on the Hill are quite upset about it. A lot of national security experts from past administrations are quite upset. You know, curiously, we haven't heard a lot from the White House and the people who were actually with Trump in Helsinki, like National Security Advisor John Bolton. It's interesting because, you know, the Russians immediately gave a lot of comments to their own media about the meeting and said it was great and much better than expected. And it was very telling, I thought, that the White House's own national security team and advisors and chief of staff were completely quiet about it. And, you know, something to note is a few people who have been real Trump allies in the past, like Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas and also Newt Gingrich, who has been a huge Trump proponent, both came out and chastised the president, which I thought was interesting. It was just people who sort of always back him up called him out in this particular instance.
Interesting that you mentioned former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. I'm looking at his statement. It is the most serious mistake of his presidency and must be corrected immediately, Gingrich wrote. Any sense what that means? I mean, how do Republicans suggest that the president correct this?
I'm not sure how he would correct it. I mean, he gave this, you know, pretty fawning performance in Helsinki with Putin, and he was very conciliatory towards him, you know, on TV in front of a whole international audience. And so I'm not sure how you walk that back at this point. You know, maybe you put more sanctions on Russia. You know, maybe you can do some things at the margins. But I'm just not sure how you walk that back. And also, you know, there was no note taker in the room for the private one-on-one meeting with Trump and Putin. So basically, no one from the U.S. government really knows exactly what was said in that meeting. And I think that is what is most troublesome to national security experts.
Yeah. And tell me more about reaction from his own party, because I guess it's fair to say that since the president's inauguration, a lot of members of his party have not been as overtly critical of him, perhaps preserving, you know, thinking of their own electoral viability and their own ability to essentially maintain channels of communication with the president. But this seems to have really shaken that way of behaving with the president, right?
Yeah, I do think that this is one of the very, very rare instances in which Republicans are speaking out against what the president has done. But you'll notice Senator Tom Cotton, for instance, in his statement, you know, didn't necessarily call out Trump by name. So I still think that there is a bit of a fear of calling him out directly. You know, Senator John McCain, I think, gave one of the most pointed statements. But again, he's you know, a longtime veteran. I feel like he's always felt like he could say these things. He's dying. Why not go for it? But, you know, I will be curious by the end of the week if there's still that level of criticism or if, like so many stories with the Trump White House, you know, Republicans are disappointed in him. They make a little bit of noise and then they sort of roll back over and everyone moves on. And so I'll be curious, is there sustained outrage about what happened? And there may be. This was a huge national security moment, and I would say one of the biggest moments of Trump's presidency in terms of how he thinks about foreign policy and how he thinks about interacting with foreign leaders.
Interesting. Yeah, you mentioned John McCain. Here's what John McCain said. Today's news conference in Helsinki was one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president in memory. No prior president has ever abased himself more abjectly before a tyrant. That from John McCain, Senator John McCain of Arizona. Nancy Cook, White House reporter for Politico, thank you so much for joining us for that quick update from Washington. We're very grateful.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us now from Washington is John Cypher. He's formerly in the CIA clandestine service. He was based in Moscow in the 1990s. And John Cypher, thanks so much for joining us. It's great to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Love to get your quick reaction. You have a particular perspective here coming from the CIA. Tell me what you're thinking about.
Well, it's interesting that in some areas it's being set up as Trump has gone against his own intelligence community. But in a more fundamental way, Trump really is moving against reality here. We hardly need an intelligence assessment to say what the Russians have been up to for the last few years, in fact, for decades. Our allies have been attacked in this information warfare, and you know, the Justice Department has put out indictments showing what the Russians have been up to here. So, yeah, this is frustrating. I mean, our intelligence agencies are pretty resilient. They'll continue to do work. They'll continue to try to support the president as best they can. But if you have a president who doesn't seem to take his national security responsibilities seriously, I think it's pretty tough.
Hmm. And say more about that as someone who worked in the clandestine service or the CIA. I mean, what does that do to the morale of folks working in that service?
Well, I want to be careful. I don't want to suggest that somehow when the morale's down, our intelligence services won't be able to do their job effectively. They will. Mm. But there is an implicit agreement between national security professionals, not just in the intelligence community, but in State Department and elsewhere, in Defense Department, that we'll provide our best assessment. We will work hard. We'll work around the world. We'll often put ourselves in harm's way to provide the president the best information we can possibly do. But if the president continually just dismisses that information and doesn't take it seriously, that does sort of break that bond. We don't expect to always be right, and we do expect to be questioned hard. But when the president openly sides with someone that we know has been working against us and attacking our country, then that's a problem, I think.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what President Trump said yesterday in Helsinki. Here he is suggesting that he trusted Vladimir Putin's word about foreign meddling over evidence presented by Dan Coats as Director of National Intelligence.
My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
And here's a little more from that press conference. After Monday's lunch meeting, reporters asked President Trump whether he would denounce Russia's meddling in the 2016 election and demand that Russian President Vladimir Putin never do it again. Here's how the president responded to that reporter's question.
I have great confidence in my intelligence people, but I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And what he did is an incredible offer. He offered to have the people working on the case come and work with their investigators with respect to the 12 people. I think that's an incredible offer.
So President Trump speaking yesterday in Helsinki alongside Russian President Vladimir Putin. With me right now from Washington is John Cypher, former member of the CIA clandestine service. He was based in Russia in the 1990s. John Cypher, how successful a summit was this for Vladimir Putin? How much did it help him?
I think it was a successful summit for Vladimir Putin, and it probably would have been even if the president hadn't said those unfortunate remarks. You know, the president of the United States oversees the largest, most powerful country and richest country in the history of the world. And he put Vladimir Putin, a dictator of a country that has a very, very small economy, has very few allies in the world, and has been sticking his finger in the eye of all of the Western powers, including the United States. And just to attack the United States election, So he gave Mr. Putin a chance to be seen on the world stage as an equal with the United States, someone that the world needs to go to make the big decisions. And so even before these unfortunate remarks, you put Mr. Putin in a position that really he came out a winner. And then you add to that some of these comments that, you know, almost denying what Russia's been up to for the last few years. It made it even harder to move forward.
And what do you make of this idea, the president giving credit to Vladimir Putin, that he offered to have the people working on the case come and work with their with his investigators with respect to the 12 people who have been indicted in Russia for election meddling? I mean, is that a serious idea that Russian investigators might work with American investigators in Russia?
There is work at the lower level between Russians and Americans. You know, in the, overseas, we're passing information on terrorist issues. Our law enforcement professionals work with the Russians. But this notion is ludicrous. There's a lot of eye-rolling probably in Washington when that was said. Mr. Putin is really good at playing these sort of clever games where he makes things look – he tries to make his country look like it's a country, a normal country based on rule of law, and he has all these procedures and things. But this is just a – you know, a political game. And if Mr. Trump fell for it, that's really sad, frankly.
Well, we were talking to Nancy Cook at the top of this hour, and even some of the president's staunchest allies, including Newt Gingrich, taking issue with what he said yesterday. And one of the things that I was sort of struck by what Newt Gingrich said, that this is the most serious mistake the president has made and must be corrected immediately. Is there any way to imagine how he could correct this mistake?
You know, he's you know, it seems like he's made a lot of mistakes over time, and people continue to think that he's going to turn the corner. But it's hard for me to see, you know, how he corrects this mistake in any kind of simple way.
Right. John Cypher, stand by. We're going to continue this conversation about the aftermath of Trump's meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin and the furious reaction from both sides of the aisle. You can join the conversation. What does this mean for U.S.-Russia relations, for national security? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're discussing President Trump's embrace of Russian President Vladimir Putin and his apparent denial of Russian election interference. You can join the conversation. If the president is sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution, do you think he failed to do that? Or is there some good reason for cozying up to an authoritarian leader who many Americans regard as this country's number one adversary. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with John Cypher, a former member of the CIA clandestine service. And joining us as well now from Washington is Andrew Weiss. He's a Russia expert and vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And Andrew, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us as well.
Great to be here.
Love to just get your initial reaction to what you're thinking about the day after Helsinki.
I think people are still in shock. This was a singularly shameful moment, and the implications and consequences of what Donald Trump did yesterday are going to be very long-lasting. Let's step back for a second. Donald Trump started the press conference and acted very Reagan-esque, and he said things that were really, I think, defensible and sort of clear-headed about why he wants to have a better relationship between the United States and Russia. People can say that would have been politically, you know, treacherous for him, but he, you know, he seemed to be able to high road a lot of what he's been advocating through tweets and other public statements. it all went just shockingly downhill from there and displayed lack of discipline. He basically set himself on fire, and he basically made what he has claimed he wants to do that much harder to achieve, which is normalize U.S.-Russian relations. And the way he did it and the spectacular effort to ingratiate himself with Vladimir Putin in front of the world, I think, backfired spectacularly. Hmm. It's going to be really toxic. Russia was already toxic in Washington. It's that much more toxic today.
And talk a little bit more about why what he did yesterday was so dramatic. Because in a sense, I guess here's the question. Was it anything new? I mean, he's been cozying up to Putin for a long while, and he's been very skeptical about the findings of his own intelligence agencies when it comes to allegations of Russian meddling in U.S. elections. So what was so different in your mind about what happened yesterday?
It went on and on and on. It basically was like watching Alex Jones on InfoWars, going into the depths of conspiracy theory, mistruth, and outright falsehood. And the attempts to basically cast doubt on the accuracy of the U.S. intelligence community assessment that Russia had dramatically and unacceptably interfered in the U.S. Domestic political environment in 2016, the fact that President Trump's national security team has been uniformly, I think, very outspoken, Mr. Pompeo, Mr. Bolton, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, they're all, you know, basically using the same talking points, which is saying this threat has not abated and that we're seeing continued Russian efforts to meddle in U.S. politics. Donald Trump could have very easily said, I take all that stuff very seriously. Donald Trump could have said, Vladimir Putin has to stop this. It's going to have an impact on our relationship. And he chose to basically say, you know, Putin was really persuasive. He really spoke very forcefully and said nothing, you know, of this sort is happening. It was one of these, you know, who are you going to believe? It was such a shocking moment, I think, for anyone who's ever been involved in this issue. It's a dark day.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more from that press conference. So before the summit, President Trump tweeted that U.S. foolishness, stupidity, and the Mueller probe were responsible for the decline in U.S. relations with Russia. When he was asked at the press conference yesterday in Helsinki if Russia could take any of the blame, here's what President Trump had to say.
We have both made some mistakes. I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all. Everybody knows it. People are being brought out to the fore. So far that I know, virtually none of it related to the campaign. And they're going to have to try really hard to find somebody that did relate to the campaign. That was a clean campaign.
Let's go to Wes, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Wes. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, Anthony. Color me unimpressed with the Republican response. I mean, Republicans are concerned and some are outraged, but just like always, Republicans will do nothing. Using Trump's whole example, he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, and in this case, Congress is going to do nothing about it. Here's an example. Last night on the PBS NewsHour, where Mr. Cipher was a guest, Rand Paul belittled McCain's comments and then drew a moral equivalence between the U.S. and Russia. So clearly, Republicans are nowhere near developing a spine to challenge Trump. And this floored me. Last night on Fox News, the news outlet that Trump publicly applauded as a real network and skipped over CNN on Friday, it was crazy, but that was a brief ray of hope. Their coverage was actually negative before, you know, but yesterday's headlines now are buried with their usual propaganda. So,
Wes, we got it, and we hear you loud and clear, and I thank you for the call. I want to move on and get another call from Canton, Ohio, from where Jim is calling. Jim, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I've opposed Trump from just about everything he's done since he's been in office, you know, immigration and all the rest. But I do support him 100% on this, because I think it's all fake news about Russia doing meddling with our elections and all that. And the only evidence they've ever been able to cite is the consensus of the intelligence community. But that's the same intelligence community that says it would be a threat to national security to release the JFK files. You know, and I don't believe anything that they say when it comes to Russia.
Okay, Jim, we hear you loud and clear. I mean, we should keep in mind that Special Counsel Robert Mueller and his team have either indicted or obtained guilty pleas from 32 people and three companies that we know of, and That group also includes some former Trump advisors. But John Cipher, let me get you to respond to the caller who seems to lack any faith, really, in the intelligence community.
Well, frankly, I don't think you even have to look at the intelligence community. If you don't trust the intelligence community, that's okay. Our job is to provide information to policymakers, and our relationship with the public is sometimes not as robust as it potentially could be. However, if you talk to any of our allies, the politicians, they will tell you what the Russians have been up to. If you follow the indictment, the indictment that came out last week has specific names, ranks, information, and exactly what the Russians were up to in cyber attacks. And so, you know, for President Trump to blame the Mueller probe somehow for poor relations with the Russians is like blaming the police for investigating after a break-in. It just doesn't make sense.
Let's take another call. Andy is calling from Buffalo, New York. Go ahead, Andy. You're on the air. Thank you for the call.
Thank you, Anthony. I don't see all that much problem with the things the president said. He talked about stupidity being part of the problem that we had leading up to our problems with Russia, and our last administration was under the impression that the 80s called and wanted their foreign policy back. People want to make a big thing about an indictment. People have said you can indict a ham sandwich. That indictment proves nothing. It's not, and it will never go to court to be proved. As far as our intelligence agencies goes, are these the same intelligence agencies, CIA, that conducted renditions of people to bring them back to be waterboarded? Are these the same intelligence agencies that told us there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq before we invaded? Are these the same intelligence agencies that gave us Snowden and gave us Manning? Are these the same intelligence agencies where Clapper lied before Congress and then got caught out on it? The intelligence agencies made a bad name for themselves a long time before this, and I've yet to see them do anything to redeem themselves to get back into the good graces where we ought to trust them on just what they say.
All right, Andy, I take your point there. But let me ask you this, Andy. I'm just curious. I mean, what we saw yesterday was an American president sort of staking out a common cause with the president of Russia. And Russia is known to be an authoritarian regime. There are a lot of mainstream Republicans who see Russia as America's number one adversary. Doesn't that concern you at all?
Well, I think about what the Russians did. Let me answer your question, sir. I think about what the Russians did when everyone talks about their meddling. They released Podesta's emails. In essence, they released the truth. People are upset because they learned the truth about how the Democrats ran their election. Now,
I think people might be upset that the Russians actually were able to infiltrate the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton's campaign in an effort to sway the U.S. election. But John Cipher, I heard you trying to get in on this conversation. Let me get you back.
Again, I would say forget the intelligence. Forget the intelligence community. Mr. Putin has taken Crimea, which is from a sovereign country. He has troops in eastern Ukraine. He's supporting the Taliban, who kill American soldiers overseas. He's on the opposite side in Syria, working with the Iranians and the Syrians, a brutal dictatorship against us, and is working to undermine our allies around the world. So forget the attack on the United States if for some reason you don't believe it. And if you don't believe the indictment, I would suggest you actually read it and see how detailed it is. But Vladimir Putin is by no means a friend. He sees the world in a zero-sum way, and anything that hurts the United States helps Russia. He's the wrong person for us to be cozying up to.
Mm. Andrew Weiss, your reaction to the last two callers, it is striking that President Trump, of course, retains an enormous amount of support, and that can be explained in a lot of ways. But there we had two callers who pretty much said, look, nothing here to see. He was just saying what was true. I mean, what's your response to that?
I think Donald Trump has a pretty free hand in general to pursue the foreign policy that he was advocating as a candidate, which basically maintains that, you know, our allies are a big pain in the neck. We have all these free riders. They're taking advantage of us. And, you know, if we withdraw from the world, it'll be better for us and we can kind of bully our way forward. And you know, he's gone about that rather consistently. And it's dressed up at times as having a more serious intellectual foundation. But it's really a kind of, you know, nativist, nationalist foreign policy. Mm. The affinity for Russia has always been there. It's, you know, he's always had a soft spot for authoritarians, whether it was the the Chinese leaders who were in charge during the Tiananmen massacre, or people like Kim Jong-un. He's spoken warmly about Putin as a businessman and as a candidate and now as president. The problem is that, you know, the U.S. political environment has really been coming apart at the seams. That was well known during the campaign. You have a country which is incredibly polarized, and the Russians inserted themselves. They didn't create that polarization. They took advantage of it. And given the segmentation of our media, given the general anger toward elites, especially in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, we were and still face, I think, a really toxic brew at home. And so it's fine to, you know, hold the Russians to account for what they did. But I think the really hard work is, you know, is facing our leaders and average citizens who have to deal with this environment. Are we going to let it persist, or are we going to be able to find resolution to some of these big problems and disconnects in our own political environment? That's not my area of expertise, but I think, you know, that's that problem and is, you know, it's a wide open target for any foreign adversary to take advantage of.
And we're talking about President Trump's press conference yesterday in Helsinki with Russian President Vladimir Putin. What did you make of what the president said of his seeming apparent chumminess with the Russian president and turning his back on his own intelligence agencies around issues of Russian meddling in U.S. elections? And let's go to Claire, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, you're on the air. Thanks so much for the call.
I thank you, Anthony. As an American, as a patriot, and as a taxpayer, I just resent this sham of a quote-unquote summit we all just paid for so that Donald Trump can go and brown-nose his idol, Vladimir Putin, and we have no idea what took place in that room.
You're talking about the private meeting he had with the Russian president, just with the translator, with the translators. Claire, thanks so much for the call. John Cypher, let me come to you about that. What about that? A relatively unprecedented meeting, I understand. I mean, the way these things usually work with these two presidents meeting one-on-one without any staff. What's the significance of that? And what do you think was said?
I don't, you know, presidents have a lot of power and they can shape things the way they want to. So a private meeting with Vladimir Putin is something that President Trump can certainly request if he wants to. You know, he has domestic political concerns, and if he's willing to take the risks that some people are going to distrust him for that, you know, that's on him. However, he did put himself in sort of a tough position because at the end of the day, President Trump is very new at this. He's not an expert by any means in foreign policy or national security matters. And Vladimir Putin is very experienced. He's been in power almost 20 years, and he's a career KGB officer who himself says that he's an expert in human relations and manipulating situations to his advantage. So he did put himself in sort of a tough position, but he's going to have to justify that. And usually when there's these kind of meetings, there are note takers. There is a record to be had. So I'm surprised that he chose to do it. And I, like the caller, I do worry about it some. But I worry more about his, on the international stage, sort of throwing domestic politics into the thing. It seems like Mr. Trump sees our overseas enemies as less important, or overseas adversaries as less important, less of a threat than the domestic politics of the Democrats. And so to attack, you know, vehemently attack your domestic opponents and let your international opponents off the hook, that's a problem for a lot of us. Mm.
Andrew Weiss, earlier in the segment, you were talking about long-lasting consequences of this. What did you have in mind specifically?
In 2014, the world had a very sharp wake-up call. No one wanted a crisis or a sharpening of tensions with Russia, but they erupted in Ukraine. And we had the launching of essentially a covert war against a country which had just undergone a popular revolt. That rebellion basically set off a series of geopolitical shockwaves that led the United States and Europe to join forces both to respond immediately and to sort of hold Russia accountable, impose a series of penalties, to do whatever they could to support Ukraine during this very difficult period of basically rebuilding a country during a period of invasion and subversion by a much bigger, more powerful neighbor. All of that required tremendous diplomatic finesse that basically President Obama and especially German Chancellor Merkel created a really united front. And they created a series of initiatives. But it would not have been possible to basically hold the line and hold things together in the absence of that unity. Donald Trump came into office, shattered it, and has now embraced Vladimir Putin. It sets the West on a very dangerous and unpredictable course.
Andrew Weiss, John Cypher, stand by. We're going to return to this conversation. We're talking about the outrage, the reaction to President Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, that press conference yesterday. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of the TED Radio Hour. In our latest episode, we're exploring the causes and consequences of hatred, what makes it such a powerful force, and why some people feel its pull more deeply. Take a listen to the TED Radio Hour on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking... And we're talking about President Trump's joint press conference yesterday with Vladimir Putin, which has left a lot of people shocked. With me are Andrew Weiss from the Carnegie Endowment for Peace and CIA veteran John Cypher. Let's listen to a little bit of tape. In a heated interview with Fox News' Chris Wallace last night, Russian President Vladimir Putin repeated his insistence that Russia did not meddle in the 2016 U.S. election, despite the findings of U.S. intelligence agencies.
Russia, as a state, has never interfered with the internal affairs of the United States, let alone its elections.
But sir, this is the indictment. It shows I have 12 names here. It talks about specific units of the GRU. Russian military intelligence. Is the GRU not part of the Russian state?
John Cypher, I want to come to you about that. And I just want to parse some of the language, if we can assume the translation is correct. There was Vladimir Putin saying Russia as a state has never interfered with the internal affairs of the United States, let alone its elections. Do you find significance in the way he words that denial, Russia as a state, as opposed to, I don't know, other players who may be associated with the Russian state?
I don't, in the sense that, you know, this is Vladimir Putin. He grew up through the KGB. Denial of the activity that they do is just part of what they do. Even if it's ludicrous, like shooting down of the Malaysian plane, they'll come up with all kinds of crazy things rather than just, you know, say the truth. So in some places they call this implausible deniability. Mm-hmm. And, you know, frankly, we don't need his answers here. We have a long history of the Russians doing exactly the things they did to us in 2016. Most intelligence agencies, what they do is they collect intelligence to provide information to policymakers to make policy. The Russians, to their intelligence agencies, their most important thing they do is subversion, is what we call active measures or political warfare. It's this use of disinformation, subversion, media manipulation, cyber attacks, deception, and even, yes, assassination, like an asymmetric warfare to take on bigger states. And they've been doing this for decades and decades. And it's exactly what we saw in 2016 against. And there's more than enough evidence and information of what they did to us in 2016, but also against almost every state in Europe. So it's silly for him to deny, but that's what you do if you're the leader of an intelligence agency and now the leader of a state.
I want to ask you both this question, Andrew Weiss. I'll come to you. Our time is winding down here, but have you ever seen anything like this before? I mean, do you know of an instance in which a U.S. president stood beside a potential adversary or an actual adversary and embraced him in this way? Andrew Weiss, has this ever happened to your knowledge?
No, there's no precedent for this. My boss, Carnegie's president, Bill Burns, who served at the State Department for about 30 years, including as ambassador to Russia, said in his entire career he's never seen a more appalling performance by a U.S. president on an international matter as important as this.
John Cypher, same question to you. Is it absolutely unprecedented in Andrew Weiss's view, yours as well?
I think it is unprecedented, and I think it hurts us in the long run. I mean, also, we have to remember spurning our allies hurts us. I mean, the bulk of the information and help we get overseas on all sorts of foreign affairs issues, and including intelligence, comes from our allies. So to spurn them and to embrace Vladimir Putin is something we've never seen before, and I think there will be a price to pay for it.
Mm. Well, John Cypher is a former member of the CIA's clandestine service. He joined us from Washington. John Cypher, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And Andrew Weiss, Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Andrew, thank you as well. It was really good to have you.
Great to be here.
Listeners, stay with us. In a moment, we're going to talk about a new poll that finds Americans more polarized than ever about everything from Russian election meddling to voting rights. Stay with us. This is On Point. So there's been a lot of talk about threats to American democracy this summer, but it turns out Americans have very different ideas about what those threats might be. A new survey suggests that for some, the big threats include the increasing political power of the very rich to control government and foreign governments interfering with elections. But others are more concerned about media bias than Russian election meddling. The new survey comes from The Atlantic and the Public Religion Research Institute and suggests that Americans are now more divided than ever. So joining me to discuss this from Washington is Robert Jones. He's the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, who administered the survey. Robert Jones, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks, Anthony.
Also with us from Washington, Atlantic reporter Emma Green, whose article about the survey results is out today. Emma Green, good to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let me start with you, Robert. What's the biggest takeaway from this poll that you'd like to highlight?
Well, I do think the divisions in the country that are not just political, they're also racial, is one of the things that just stands out, and particularly when we're looking at really threats to our democracy and threats to our voting system in particular. And, you know, the bridge finding from the conversation you've been having is a question about outside interference by foreign governments. Now, overall, it looks like there's only 45% of the country that says this is a major problem with our election system. But if you look under the hood a little bit, that 45% goes in two very different ways politically. So only 22% of Republicans, but 68% of Democrats say this is a major problem. So on this topic, and I should be clear, this survey was in the field prior to the press conference yesterday. So this is where the dial was set prior to this conversation. But that's a nearly 50 percentage point gap between Republicans and Democrats on their perceptions of how big a problem outside interference by foreign governments in our electoral system is. And that carries over to a number of other things. You mentioned media bias and influence of wealthy individuals. And here again, the two political parties are really mirror images of one another on the influence of wealthy individuals and corporations. 8 in 10 Democrats, but only 4 in 10 Republicans say that's a major problem. But when you get to media bias against certain candidates, it completely flips. Only about 4 in 10 Democrats, but about 8 in 10 Republicans and 8 in 10 white evangelical Protestants, by the way, also say that media bias is a major problem. So we have this just real divide in the country.
So essentially, groups of people will be looking at the exact same set of facts, but come to very, very different conclusions.
Yeah, that's right. I think that is one of the real challenges here. You know, if you think about, I mean, democracies are kind of fragile things, and they depend on at least a baseline of consensus on some, you know, basic facts, and really the arguments are only productive when they are really working from at least a baseline set of understandings. And I think one of the real worries and threats here is that on many, many of these very important issues, Americans, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, or whether they're white or African American, are seeing two very different realities.
Mm. So, Emma Green, let me come to you and tell me about your article, which is out this morning, if I have that correct. How did your reporting supplement this survey's findings? Give us a sense.
So what we see in this survey are two very different stories about the state of American democracy. In general, a sense of pessimism, perhaps, from both Republicans and Democrats, conservative, liberal, but more broadly, just a different sense of what's ailing us as a country. This is something that I have seen in my reporting focusing on religion and politics, talking to people in local churches, asking people about their reactions to politics, and just getting a real sense that at these core institutions, at local levels, people have radically different ideas about the state of our country. We see that in some of the numbers that Robbie just mentioned, but more broadly, I think we need to pay attention to the way that people are constructing the story that they tell about themselves, their identity, and what's ailing our current electoral system.
So say more about that. What do you mean about paying attention to the way people are constructing their stories about what ails the U.S. and its institutions? Say a little bit more about that. I find that really intriguing.
Yeah. So, for example, a couple of the numbers that stuck out to me from this survey were about problems with voting, either ineligible voters going to cast votes when they shouldn't be, so voter fraud, or voters who are eligible being suppressed. And there were inversions between Democrats and Republicans in the way that they viewed these being a problem. Republicans more likely to see voter fraud as the biggest issue, whereas Democrats were more likely to see voter suppression. But, for example, I was really struck by one of the sort of demographic cuts there. We looked at the strong majorities of Black and Hispanic voters saying that voter suppression is a major issue. And then on the flip side, white people and even white Democrats didn't seem to think it was that big of a deal. So that kind of experience, that sense that my friend or my cousin has actually experienced this at the voter booth, really shaped the way that people were reacting to this question.
Hmm. Robert Jones, I'd like to talk to you about this, what Emma's referring to, how the poll found different attitudes when it comes to voting about who's qualified to vote and what disqualifies people from voting. There seems to be a real misunderstanding about that in large numbers. How big of a concern is that to you?
Well, I have to say this is one of the – these were a new set of questions for us, and so we didn't have a baseline. And I was really surprised at the amount of uncertainty and really a lack of knowledge about what our voting laws are. And, you know, so it really does paint a picture of people, particularly I think being vulnerable, who are eligible voters but who might believe that they are not eligible voters based on a whole range of things. I'll give you a couple of examples though. We asked a whole battery of questions about what kinds of things qualified you or disqualified you from being an eligible voter. And on every question we asked, there was at least a quarter of the country who said they were unsure. And on some of them, they ranged as high as 60% of the country saying they're unsure. So, for example, we asked about, you know, can you vote if you don't have a permanent address? 60% of the country says they don't know whether that disqualifies you from voting. And then on other things like being late to pay your taxes, having outstanding parking tickets or unpaid utility bills, these are things that do not disqualify anyone from voting. And yet about half the country says they're not sure if simple things like that would disqualify them from voting. And for example, being late to pay your taxes, up to 60% of African Americans say they're not sure if that would disqualify them from voting.
Wow. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. So, Emma Green, big differences in attitudes that divide along racial and ethnic lines, right?
Yeah, we see that at several different points in the survey. I think the experience around voter suppression and the perceptions there was the one that stuck out to me the most. But more broadly, I think we see that there is a breakout along race that is sort of intermingled with these different senses of who people are. It's always hard to tell in a survey whether the fact that someone's a Democrat or the fact that they're Hispanic, the fact that someone's Republican or the fact that they're white is what's really influencing them. But we saw in general, a really interesting sort of split apart where you had strong numbers from racial minorities and people who identified as Democrats on certain standards and questions. And then on the other side, Republicans generally tending to be white, having a whole different perception. So it was sort of a splitting apart of groups into these two camps of narratives about our democracy.
Robert Jones, I want to come back and ask you a question that's a little bit more related to what we were talking about in the first part of this hour, and that is a reaction to what happened in Helsinki and reaction to Russian meddling in elections. And, you know, I was struck by how we heard a real divergence of views from our callers. Some people saying, you know, this is shocking and obviously the president behaved terribly, and other people calling and saying, look, you know, our intelligence services have gotten us involved in wars we shouldn't have been involved in. Why are we believing them? This is a long way to get to this question. Are there events that happen that you see actually move the needle in polling like this? That is, could one suppose that what happened in Helsinki will make people, I don't know, more inclined to distrust President Trump's view of his relationship with President Putin, for example?
Well, I'll give the, you know, required pollster answer, and that is, we'll see. Right? These are empirical questions right. that have to be decided with a future snapshot, which we will certainly be looking into. This survey is part of a series of surveys that we're actually doing in partnership with The Atlantic, and so we'll have another set of surveys coming up. One more actually before the midterm, so we'll be able to kind of test the waters. But the other thing I would say, though, is that one of the interesting things we're seeing, I think, is that. Many of these kind of allegiances and the needle is hard to see the needle move because much of the polarization, as Emma mentioned, along lines of race and along lines of religion and along lines of party are kind of baked into our politics, and they have been baked into our politics over decades. And so I think that is the real challenge for us here that, you know, again, if you look at this, the saying outside interference by foreign governments, if you have a favorable view of Trump, only 22% of people who had a favorable view of President Trump said that outside interference was a major problem compared to 61% who have an unfavorable view of Trump. So people are just seeing through these partisan lenses, and they are – if it was just partisanship, that would be one thing. But the way the U.S. politics have developed, it is race and religion that are also being baked in. And these are very visceral, tribal kinds of identities that have now been all fused along lines of partisanship. And I think it's really as notable as the previous guests were saying that it's notable that the Russians, even in 2016, the evidence is that one of their main strategies is they were exploiting these divisions along race and religion and partisanship as a strategy for disrupting society. And I think we're looking at it, you know, we need to take a very serious look at kind of the whole democratic system and realize that we are at a point where these divisions, which I think we've taken to be these domestic disputes and that don't leave our borders in some way, but that these divisions are deep enough now that they are actually becoming a national security risk for the country and for a healthy democracy.
We have literally 15 seconds left. I want to ask you, Robert Jones, very quickly, your question about the 2018 midterm elections, a sort of generic question about who's voting in which direction. What did you find?
Well, we find Democrats up by 11 points there. And I think one of the more interesting things here is that we're not finding a higher uptick among young people in the election. So that young people activism, which we do see in other surveys, is not translating into voting, at least in this survey. However, African-Americans are three times as likely to say all of their friends are going to be voting in the midterm election than whites are. And I think that's a number to really watch.
All right. Robert Jones, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Emma Green, staff writer for The Atlantic, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.